Good afternoon. You're at the session, PFAS regulation and housewares update. The times are changing. Fran Grosbeck is appearing at the Innovation Theater to lead a panel discussion that will provide an overview on PFAS chemicals used to make a wide range of housewares products. The panel will discuss what the industry members need to know about new legislative requirements related to PFAS. Is that what you usually call it, or full PFAS? Okay.
PFAS.
I've read it more than I've talked about it. Fran Grosbeck is Managing Director of the Cookware and Bakeware Alliance. She is owner and founder of 10 Touch Creative Agency, where she has applied more than 27 years of experience to build a creative agency that helps businesses market better, smarter, and more efficiently. Tobias Griffin is CEO of Gunukan, a premium cookware manufacturer, and he's the president of the European Cookware Association and here under their auspices. And Tom Lee is a attorney with Brian Cave, Leighton Paisner, and a partner in the firm. So, Lee, we're off.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. It's all good. Hi, everyone. So I am super excited to be here, and I know that's probably not a word you thought to be attached with PFAS, but I am because by you all being here, it shows that you're interested and engaged in this topic and want to know more. And this is a complex topic, and that's why we're here today. So I just want to point out a couple of things before we move on. So we all have something in common. We want to understand this. We want to do the right thing. And we care about knowledge and learning and standing together. So that's why we're here today. As Mike mentioned, my name is Fran Grosbeck, and I'm the managing director at the Cookware and Bakeware Alliance. I've spent 30 years in this industry, and this is my dream job, to stand and represent the industry and help educate and inform on this really important topic. I want to clarify that as the CBA, we represent all products, all materials. We're not here to defend or talk about any specific type of product. We're here to talk about this very big topic of the legislation, what's happening with it in Europe, what's happening in the US, what you need to know. And we stand by science. That's all. And what the science says today is what we'll present to you. And as science learns more, which it always does, we'll bring that to you as well. As we learn and grow, our hope is that you will turn to all of us here. There's a lot of misinformation out there. There's also a lot of information that can cause panic and concern. We're here to say, if you hear that, if you have anything you need clarified, come to one of us. This is what we spend a lot of time living, breathing, and studying. So please, we're here to help. This topic of PFAS legislation is an important and growing topic in our industry. And it's no longer just focused on nonstick cookware. In fact, it's no longer focused on just cookware. And that's a big message of this presentation today. If your product comes in contact with food, you are part of this. And as legislation evolves, we have a lot of bills that have been reintroduced. They're covering consumer products, very broad. Doesn't mean that they'll end up being very broad legislations if they pass, but the attention to this topic has grown beyond just our industry, and that's a big message of why we're here today. Just have to say this, please note all the information here is not legal advice, and if you have anything you want to take action on, we do highly recommend that you review it with an attorney or your own legal counsel. At the CBA, I am very lucky to have partners like the FEC and BCLP Law, so I thank Tom and Tobias for joining us today. I jumped too far. I went back too far, sorry. This mouse is not cooperating with me. So before we jump into the actual topic of PFAS, I want to give you a quick update on the CBA. Some of you may know us as the Cookware Manufacturers Association, and we are now the Cookware and Bakeware Alliance. And it is a vital housewares trade association, delivering critical industry resource as a voice of authority and influence, uniting the industry by setting engineering standards for product and consumer safety. And this is a big topic that we are dealing with for the industry. We set standards, create powerful connections inside our markets, and with strategic partners and, of course, solutions to topics facing our industry, such as what we're here to talk about today, these are some of the powerful benefits of being part of the CBA. So we continue to look for and work with partners and partner companies to help us manage big topics like this. And two of our most incredible partners, as I mentioned, are FEC and BCLP Law. So I really appreciate Tobias and Tom joining us today. For the following slides, we're going to provide a quick update on what PFAS is for anyone still learning and trying to understand the chemistry. We'll then talk about what's happening in the EU, which I'm sure a lot of you have heard about. And then Tom's going to walk us through a state-by-state update. That will be a little condensed, but we have all the slides, and when they're shared, you'll get more information in there. But there's a lot going on that you need to at least see what's happening. So I'm going to Tobias has a great analogy. I'm going to turn it over to him for a second to ask you all a question.
So I'm the guy from Europe, and I'm also, I studied physics and chemistry, and PFAS is an extremely complicated topic with more than 10,000 substances. And if you're not a chemist, you cannot really digest the amount of materials or substances that are around. Who has heard that PFAS are toxic? Please raise your hands. How many of the 10,000 do you think are toxic? Nobody knows, because only about 50 to 60 have really been studied, and all others we don't know. Mushrooms, the thing we show here, there are about 14,000 mushrooms in the world. And some of them are toxic, some of them are not. In Europe and in some states in the United States, as we'll hear later on, there is regulation on the way to ban all PFAS because they are persistent and supposedly toxic. That's the analogy we have here. Does anybody in the room want to ban all mushrooms because there are a few that are toxic? And there is one big difference between the mushrooms and the PFAS. I'm not aware, and I asked a lot of other people that are even deeper into the topic, whether they know any substance within the PFAS that is as toxic as some mushrooms, and we are not aware of any of those. If you look at the very famous PFOA, and you go into the literature, you find out that PFOA is as toxic as coffee. So I hand it back.
Thank you, Tobias. And in the amount of time it took us to understand which ones of those 14,000 mushrooms were toxic and which ones were edible, it took science time to do that. And that is what we implore legislators to be doing right now. Take the right time in science to figure out which ones are the safe ones, which ones are not, and put cookware and bakeware aside for a moment, and you'll see this in a little while, the number of industries impacted by this topic goes far beyond us and into realms where people could become unsafe. In the medical industry, if PFAS were banned, you could set hospitals back 100 years and keep protecting doctors and patients. So this isn't just about us, it impacts us. We are here to help you navigate that, but it's also bigger than us. And letting science do its job is really important right now. So what is PFAS? And I'm going to just give a shout out to our Good Science logo here. And you'll see that below it, it says knowledge seekers welcome. And I welcome you to that club, because if you're here, you seek knowledge, not just taking information and running with it. That is a section of our website that's public. So you can access videos and other information there. And we'll talk about that in a second. And there is a flyer over there. But PFAS is a group of chemicals that, when used, their intention is to enhance or achieve a certain outcome with the betterment of that product and or situation in mind. There are thousands of these chemicals in this family, and keep in mind, there's only about 600, although this could have changed in commerce, but roughly 600. This large family of chemicals do not all look the same. There are different groups, and each group has different characteristics. But they further define them and the key risk factors to be considered as well. And again, not all of these are used in commerce. The first step in understanding PFAS include looking at whether it's a fluorochemical or a fluoropolymer, whether it's short chain or long chain, whether it's polymeric versus non-polymeric, water soluble versus non-water soluble. And then once you have navigated all of that, you have to look at the three key risk factors in each one, which is persistence, mobility, and toxicity. But it's a scale. So each of those thousands of chemicals, you have to navigate all those first categories I mentioned, and then you have to rate it on the three elements. There's a lot to understand and study, and we've only touched the tip of the iceberg. Understanding each individual chemical's rank on each of those factors is a very different risk profile that's identified. And this is what some agencies like ECHA in Europe and EPA are trying to understand. And they need time to do so. And this is just a snapshot of the complexity. We could do a whole series of sessions at the Innovation Theater on what PFAS is and what you need to know, but that's a high-level overview. When we talk about the legislation in the US, there's two types you need to know about, which is the right-to-know laws and then outright bans. We support the right-to-know laws. This is along the lines of what cosmetics did. Consumers have the right to know, and we were talking about this earlier. This is a big part of just in consumer trends. Consumers are asking for transparency. Think of companies like Patagonia and the success that they've had. It's because of the transparency with their consumers. So AB 1200 in California, Colorado 1345, these are right-to-know laws, and Tom's going to talk more about those in a moment. It's when we get into those that want to ban that we have some concern, and we've seen this in other industries, because outright bans or that kind of extreme thinking can lead to regrettable substitutions or unintended consequences, food packaging being one of them. So AB 1200 in California and Colorado's HB 1345, those are right-to-know laws. And both were enacted as of January 1st, so hopefully everyone in the audience who is involved in their products are defined as in the cookware realm of these legislations. You have your web page built, you have your information on there, and the next step in those laws coming for AB 1200 will be a packaging later on in 2024. There are also laws that prohibit or ban PFAS. There's the one in Maine that evolved, and right now, as enacted, it's a reporting law that is on, they're defining the reporting right now, and again, Tom will cover that in his presentation. There are other laws that have been, they died in chamber last year and been brought back in broader scope here, and these legislations that propose a full ban, even if they haven't been enacted as of today, they're causing a lot of confusion, and there are a lot of other products now being included in these proposed legislations. Those legislations can have very dangerous and broader impact on industries like electronics, automotive, energy. Not sure how many people realize the impact of fluoropolymers on things like cell phones, 5G networks, computers, renewable energy. Tesla wouldn't be around anymore. All of these industries, aerospace, they would all be impacted by these decisions. They all rely on PFAS chemicals to work. My last point before I turn it over to Tobias for a European update. If you read the legislation and you look at the definition of cookware, if you look at the first one, it is not just about pots and pans. It is about anything that is used to prepare, dispense, or store food, foodstuffs, or beverages. It includes pots, pans, skillets, grills, baking sheets, baking molds, trays, bowls, and cooking utensils. It is a very broad definition. And this is changing into consumer products, as I mentioned earlier as well. So it is beyond just cookware now, and please get educated and find out if your products are impacted. So right now I'd love to turn it over to Tobias for an update on Europe. Oh, one more. These are the industries impacted that rely on PFAS technology. So I want to make you aware that it's not just cookware anymore.
It is important that we don't want to stop restrictions, because if something is bad, it has to be banned. There's no question about that. And there are some PFAS, and I think the key point is at some point we have to go away from that expression PFAS, because there are so many different ones, and every time you use it, you throw everything in the same basket. So somehow you have to get rid of this and say, we are talking about PFOA, we are talking about Gen X, we are talking about PFOS. This is important. That should be done, and EPA is going in this direction, which is really very nice. Unfortunately, Europe is at the moment not going in this direction. It is so complicated that they decided, let's take all of them and ban all, more or less. There are some very, very few exceptions. What does it mean for this industry? You see that here. All PTFE-coated cookware, if that goes through, will be banned 18 months after entering into force. From that moment on, PTFE would be banned in Europe. I will come back to the timeline in a minute. And, which is a little bit strange to us, applications on coated bakeware for professional use, you have a time of 6.5 years. I have not found out yet why they have a differentiation between the two, and you really have to look. By the way, don't read it, the Annex E, unless you are forced to. It's 580 pages, and so it's very, very long. So it's this, but we have to keep in mind, this is a draft of a law or a regulation. So it is not a regulation. So if anybody comes to you and tells you you have to implement it now, the answer is no, you don't. I give you an example. If there is a change in taxes in your state with increase of taxes, do you pay the moment the draft goes into the parliament, you immediately start to pay higher taxes? Probably not. So you don't have to do it immediately. But you have to prepare yourself. And with the next slide, we have the timeline, and you see that in February, the draft was published, February 7, a very long document with a lot of annexes, and then the first couple of weeks, they need to look whether it is according to European law. So that is the first few weeks that it takes, and then there will be, from March 22nd to September 22nd, there will be a 6 months period of consultation. So everybody can give his feedback. This will be a nightmare for these committees. And I give you the reason is two slides before. Fran showed you all the different industries that are hit. A lot of industries thought this is just about outdoor clothing, this is about cookware, and then they got this draft. There was a webinar from the Fluoropolymer Group in Europe, and then in this webinar there were 1,800 attendees. A lot of them were just deeply shocked because they had our industry? That's impossible. We have no alternative. How should we get out of it? And that means this law will make a lot of changes. We have no idea what will happen with cookware, but it will take a long time. So the goal for them to have some win with the opinions, be ready in 2024, might be 2025, and then comes a European specialty. In the EU, all 27 states have to say yes. If one of them says no, there comes the negotiation up and down, and so it will be very interesting to see what the final version is. So what is the recommendation that we can do as the European Association? Get ready, get prepared, because if it comes through, you only have 18 months to change. But don't throw all your products out of the door already now, because it might be that you're not even hit, because it might be that they change it again. So it's not clear at the moment, but it is very concerning, because if it comes through, 18 months is very short. So really have a close look at it. If you sell in Europe, then be ready. The negative part, before I give hand back, is that a lot of of American states are looking at the European draft at the moment and start to copy that. So this will have an immediate impact in states, in the United States, with their local bills. So I am convinced there will be a sort of avalanche of local bills. And so this is probably the major concern, because this will come a lot faster. But that's my gut feeling. I have no proof for that, so I cannot say that there's clear evidence for that, but that's what I assume that would happen.
Thank you. Thank you, Tobias. And isn't it what you mentioned on it needing to be unanimous? Right now, there's already a country standing against the complete ban in Italy, correct?
Italy didn't decide yet, but of course, for the Italian industry, that is a big impact. And so they really want to make sure that they're not hit that much. So I think they underestimated, and that's similar to some states in the US, they underestimated the impact. A lot of the politicians thought it's, and you see that sometimes in the news, the chemical PFAS, so singular PFAS, and they don't even realize that it's so many. And the politicians have the same issue. So Italy will be probably against that, some others will be against that, and some countries will not be in favor because they realize, oh, it also hits this industry.
All those underage.
So it will be a very long process, but that's good because democracy is working. So that's a good thing that it's like that.
Thank you. And I turn it over to Tom now for the U.S. update.
Great. Thank you both. And thanks, everyone, for being here and listening to this. I think kind of picking up on that theme from Tobias of surprise and lack of understanding. I mean, PFAS is such a challenging space because our understanding of the chemistry is evolving, our understanding of how it's interacted with industry, broad industry groups, including yours, is evolving. And there's still a lot of uncertainty in supply chains about where it is actually present and how it's being used. So in the face of all that uncertainty, states have begun regulating, and there are some very important laws that apply to members of the cookware industry and housewares more broadly. So the purpose of this session is to give you a very quick overview. I could do probably an hour on each of these laws. So I think these slides should be available, but as Fran said at the beginning, this is a very complex area, so if you have any specific questions, we can always talk about those later. So where are these things being regulated in the United States? As you can see here, from a very high-level standpoint, we're seeing regulation in a lot of the states that are historically more activist on environmental issues. So we're seeing regulations in Washington State, California, some of the New England states. What's interesting to me is that we're also seeing things more in the middle of the country, and we're seeing this across the board on PFAS legislation. It's not just in consumer products, but in things like drinking water standards, groundwater standards. It is a bipartisan issue. It is often driven by both public opinion, but also by very active NGOs who are out there lobbying state legislators very aggressively. So this is just a quick overview of what's in place and what is coming. And you'll see on the left, there are the notice consumer information laws, and the right, there are the bans. What's interesting, I think, here is that you'll see more proposed laws on the right-hand column and more enacted laws on the left. And we've seen a shift from things initially being proposed as a ban and eventually transferring into more of a consumer rights and no law. So, you know, when we look at this, it certainly seems like the trend is towards more legislation banning the use of PFAS. Whether or not those proposed bills will end up in that form, we'll see. Maybe just to highlight very quickly, because to illustrate how fast this area is moving from a legislative standpoint, on Thursday, Minnesota had an environmental committee which approved a proposed bill, which is actually a ban of PFAS. It bans non-essential PFAS in a variety of household products, including cookware. Now, the bill hasn't been enacted. It will now go through additional committee review and eventually be probably brought to the floor, but it's getting a lot of attention, and it is a very broad sort of EU-style ban on the whole category of non-essential PFAS. So point being, this is a very active, very ongoing issue across the country in a number of states. So what has actually been passed? What applies today? There is an important law in Colorado, HB 1345. So the requirements are beginning on January 1st, 2024, cookware manufacturers are required to list all intentionally added PFAS on the label. You are also required to have a website that provides the relevant information as well. And an explanation of why you're including these PFAS substances in your product. To go back to an excellent point that Fran made, the definition of cookware is not just pots and pans. This is broad. It is intentionally casting a wide net on the industry. And it's not determined by whether or not your product has a plug attached to it. So, you know, electronic products are potentially in scope for a lot of these laws if they otherwise meet the definition. So just want to flag for everyone that, you know, we haven't seen any regulatory enforcement under Colorado's law. We haven't really seen any under California's law, which I'll talk about in a minute yet. But now is the opportunity to do your investigation, get into compliance, and I think the laws are intentionally broad, and enforcement likely will be as well. So a lot of the laws share a definition of PFAS, and so I just wanted to highlight that here, because as Tobias and Fran have both mentioned, you can define this family in a lot of different ways. There is disagreement about how many chemicals are even in the family. Under one definition, there's 5,000, under another, there's 10, and another, there's 12. When I started doing these presentations 3.5 years ago, we were talking about 2,000 to maybe 3,000 PFAS compounds. So this language is incredibly important to help you understand the full scope of what falls under the law. So the Colorado and California definition is any chemical that includes a fully fluorinated carbon atom. And that's about as broad as it gets. It includes things that aren't really what we view as PFAS. So there are some pesticides that fall under this. There are some pharmaceuticals that might fall under this. So it's amazingly broad. And again, cookware also very broadly defined, both in the use description and in the examples of products that they've provided in the statute. There's another component to all this, though, that I think I haven't seen as much coverage on in the media, and I think it's really important when you think about both your regulatory risk, but also your litigation risk, which is Colorado's law and California's too prohibits the kind of marketing claims that you can make about your product. So you cannot say that your product is free of any PFAS if your product contains any intentionally added PFAS. So if you have one PFAS in there that's intentionally added, you can't say that you're PFOA free or PFOS free or PFAS free. Any member of the family disqualifies all those marketing statements. And I'll just, as a quick side, the main litigation risk that we're seeing in the consumer product space right now is exactly this kind of marketing claim liability. So false claims and false advertising lawsuits are popping up across the country. There's been some very high profile cases against McDonald's, Burger King. There was a $5 million settlement with Thinks recently. Coca-Cola just got hit with a suit. There's a new litigation related to butter. The common thread in all of those is that the brand made claims on their packaging and or on their website that said that the products were safe, that they were all natural, that they were made with certain ingredients. And the argument the plaintiffs are making is those are false claims when in fact your products contain PFAS. So we're really here to talk about regulatory liability, but I do want to flag for everyone that it's important to look at your marketing statements as well to fully capture the potential risk here. There is an exception to Colorado's law and California's, which I have to flag, but I think it is very limited in its applicability. If your product is so small that you cannot fit a 2x2 sticker on it, then you don't have to comply. Well, and there's no overwrap where you could put a warning. But I think for most people in this room, that's not going to be a major exemption. So then we go to California's AB 1200. And what's interesting about this one is it decouples the website and the on-label warning. So the website warning requirement went into effect in January of this year. So it is currently effective. And what you need to do is provide a disclosure of the chemicals that are intentionally added in your product, and it needs to be on the product page. And this is a big issue that people in the industry have been struggling with, is how do you do that? You know, do you reformulate each individual product landing page to include a list of all the compounds? Some have opted to have a link that takes you to a reference list. But that's, you know, How the compliance is ultimately affected is something that's still sort of developing, but it is a requirement that's currently in effect. And you have to include a list of all the designated chemicals that are in the product in the food contact or beverage contact surface or in the handle of the product. And I'll pause there to highlight one of the key differences between California and Colorado. So in Colorado, it is just focused on PFAS. That's all you have to look for. That's all you have to disclose. And again, it's in the food contact or handle area of the product. In California, it is not just PFAS. It is all chemicals on DTSC, California Agency, on their candidate chemicals list. Currently, there are over 3,000 compounds on that list. For those of you who've had the perhaps displeasure of dealing with Prop 65, it includes all 900 plus chemicals that are on that list, and it includes things like metals and phthalates and, you know, a wide range of compounds that have nothing to do with PFAS. So when you're thinking about what is in your handles and your food contact surfaces, just remember that in California, you know, we're talking about a lot more than just PFAS. So then in 2024, the requirement includes on-label warnings. And it's generally the same information. You have to list, excuse me, you have to list all the designated chemicals that are in the product in those two areas, which means some product labels are gonna get pretty unwieldy unless California issues some kind of rule or clarification, providing a way to limit how many of those compounds you have to put on your label. But as written, the law requires you to list everything on your product label. And then the label, like in Colorado, has to include a reference to the website where people can find more information. And again, marketing claims. And this is already in effect in California. So on your website, you cannot make a claim that your product is free of a designated chemical if any member of that family is intentionally added to your cookware product. And January 2024, that prohibition goes into effect for product labels. So Colorado, everything goes into effect in January 2024. California website marketing claims are now subject to that limitation. And again, not just limited to PFAS. So I thought it'd be helpful to have kind of a comparison chart here between the two laws because they're related, but you know, it's a Venn diagram, it's not a perfect overlap. So as we said, the key, I think the most important distinction is the fact that California is not just a PFAS law. It applies to so many more chemicals. And, you know, for example, it includes certain metals that are in stainless steel alloy. So if your product has a stainless steel handle, those alloy materials need to be included on your website and on your product label. So it's a real compliance challenge that the industry needs to adjust to. Other than that, the two laws are generally the same. There are some differences in the specifics of what needs to be included on the website or in the labels. But by and large, you know, compliance with California, or at least an understanding of what you need to disclose for California, will give you the tools you need to comply with Colorado. So, Prop 65, nobody's favorite topic. It is another consumer right to know law passed in 1986, so it's been around for a long time. The way Prop 65 is developed in the PFAS world is they've added certain PFAS compounds to the list of chemicals that you have to provide a warning for. So there are three currently listed, PFOA, PFOS, and PFNA. Now, for anyone who's dealt with this word soup before, those are the compounds you would expect to see. They're the long chain historically used, as Tobias said. They're the ones where we have a slightly better understanding of their health impacts. What I think a lot of people are missing, though, is with the PFOS listing, PFOS, yes, it sounds just like PFOS, PFAS. I didn't make these up. It's not just that one compound. It includes all of its transformation and degradation precursors. And DTSC published a non-exhaustive list, so kind of an example list, of 196 other PFAS compounds that fall under that umbrella. And that's non-exhaustive, so there are others out there. So we haven't seen that issue be really explored by the enforcement groups, but as you can see, enforcement is escalating in this space. So California Prop 65 is about 98% enforced by private law firms and private plaintiffs, not by the state. We really didn't see much PFAS enforcement early on, but just in 2022, there was a huge uptick. There were 18 new cases filed, and there had only been 8 in the preceding years. So it is very much on the rise, and I think one of the challenges people are gonna face, industry will face, is as a result of federal and other state laws, there's gonna be increased reporting, increased permitting, and a paper trail that plaintiffs can look at to associate industries and specific companies with interactions with this chemistry. So it's only gonna get easier for enforcement groups to target companies. So Prop 65, you know, it's not all that hard to comply. There are limited warning requirements, but it is sort of a box you need to check in your compliance efforts. All right, so AB 652 is essentially a prohibition on the manufacture, sale, or distribution of children's products that contain intentionally added regulated PFAS. Regulated PFAS is defined as either intentionally added, so any amount of PFAS, if you put it in there for a purpose, or over 100 parts per million of total organic fluorine, which maybe you didn't intend to include in your product. Goes into effect in July of this year, so it's coming up. And children's products is pretty broadly defined to include anything that's intended for use by children under 12 years of age. I think there has not been nearly enough attention in industry publications around this, so I'm so glad that Fran is highlighting this and Tobias as well, because it really, you know, it is a true ban, and it is coming up very soon. Interestingly, you know, one of the big questions in this whole area is, what are we going to use? How are we going to replace this chemistry? And this law and some of the other children's products bans addresses that. It requires that you replace the PFAS with the least toxic alternative, which is undefined. So not very helpful, unfortunately. But, you know, there's at least an acknowledgement that there needs to be some stewardship of what the replacement chemistry will be. But unfortunately, meeting that standard will be the responsibility of industry as you transition your formulations. This one can have criminal penalties associated with it, which is not unusual for children's product laws. So, you know, the regulatory enforcement risk can be fairly significant. SB 343 in California is another one that I think a lot of people aren't quite focused on in the way they should be. So this doesn't relate to cookware specifically, it relates to packaging and product packaging and whether or not you can say that your packaging is recyclable. And I know, the most interesting topic one could imagine, but it's important. What this law does is it prohibits you from calling your, or labeling your packaging as recyclable if it contains either intentionally added PFAS or the presence of PFAS at or above 100 parts per million. So it's a regulatory risk that I think people are focused on the industry-specific regulations and laws and haven't really focused on these sort of broader but very much related risks.
May I add something?
Please.
In the packaging, PFAS are often used in cardboard. And if you have received the cardboard from suppliers, reach out to them and ask them what type of cardboard it is. Because it could be all of a sudden that you're above the 100 ppm and you're in the middle of that problem and you can get sued. So we recommend that you really get to your suppliers, define it, and get their feedback.
Thanks. Yeah, PFAS has been used in treatments for a variety of products including a lot of cardboard, paperboard products, particularly if you're trying to give it a water or grease resistant property. That's why we see it in a lot of food packaging. So Maine's law is sort of the main ban, the use prohibition that's been enacted in the United States. The first deadline, January 1st, 2023, was the disclosure deadline. So required that industry and across all industries, anyone who sells products in Maine that contain PFAS was required to notify Maine DEP about what individual PFAS compounds are in it, why are they in the product. Maine offered a 6-month extension to almost anyone who asked. So most groups have gotten that extension. It's 6 months from the date that they enact a final rule explaining how the law should be interpreted. So there has been a proposed rule released. It is going up for public comment and analysis. It's unclear when the rule will be finalized. I think we're generally expecting the disclosure deadline will be somewhere towards the end of this year or early next year. And I know Fran and others are involved in that process. So if you have any concerns about how it's going to impact your business or your industry, now is a great time to get involved, to try to provide the education and commentary that's needed to really make that an effective law. And then beginning January 2030, the prohibition goes into effect. So you would no longer be allowed to sell a product in Maine that contains intentionally added PFAS, unless you can convince Maine DEP that there's no alternative. I think the consensus is that's going to be very hard to do, especially by 2030, and even more so if the EU has gone forward with their regulations and it's already been prohibited in a major market. But there is that exception if applicable. Last thing I'll touch on quickly, look at coming attractions. Washington State has identified cookware as a category of concern. They haven't implemented any regulations yet. They have for other product categories. We expect them to take a look at cookware sometime soon. And I'll skip over the EU since Tobias covered all that. But I will just say there is a huge swath of proposed legislation on PFAS and cookware and other industries. I'm not going to go through all of them here, but just focus you guys on the fact that the slides are here. If you have any questions, we can talk about them, or you can study the slides. As you can see, there's a lot. The last thing I'll say, and maybe this is something we can cover in response to the questions as well, but in terms of what you can do, we talked a lot about sort of the doom and gloom here, but there are some very practical steps that can be taken to start understanding what the risk of these new laws and what we anticipate to be future laws, what that risk looks like for your business. So understanding, do we use PFAS? Is it present in our products? Is it present in the food contact surfaces and handles? And talking to your suppliers and vendors. And it's not an easy conversation most of the time. Your suppliers may not know, and it is not always an easy question to answer. So looking at SDS sheets for anything that has the word fluoro in it, talking to your suppliers, thinking about testing where appropriate. I think the overall message is there are already laws in effect that impact this industry. There will be more over the next few years, and they may get more stringent. So understanding now how you are impacted will allow you to react and get into immediate regulatory compliance, minimize your litigation risk from false claims lawsuits, and think about reformulation in anticipation of future bans. So I know that was a lot to digest, but hopefully it was all clear, and if it wasn't, we can talk later.
Questions. And just to further to Tom's point, especially on the right to know laws, it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to become transparent with your consumer. These laws are happening because consumers have felt fooled and they're upset, and the trends that we are seeing in consumer studies is they want to know their brands. They want to know what's in their products. They want to feel connected too. So legislation aside, while yes, you should be complying, you should also see this as an opportunity to connect with your consumer and start to communicate with them on what's in your products. I just want to touch real quickly, there's two flyers over there. I want to mention that a lot of the efforts and the work we're doing at the CBA is a great tribute to our Engineering Standards Committee. And I want to thank all of them, some of them are, who are in attendance today. And we take on these complex issues and have created some incredible materials to help support our members and navigate this. One is our PFAS legislation tracker. The other was how to navigate PFAS legislation for the two rights and NOLA laws before it went enacted January 1st. These are special member-only documents. We do an industry news for every legislation that we're faced with, what you need to know, and what you need to be doing about it. We keep them updated. They are living documents. And the last thing is we do support the industry as well. That's why we're here. And there's both videos and some PFAS education documents on our Good Science webpage. Please visit them. We are in process of working on our PFAS education document number 2, specific to cookware and the topic of PTFE, which, just to clarify, I know we haven't touched on the science of these things, but the science, we stand by science. We don't stand behind a specific product or lobby for something, but the science on fluoropolymers right now is they are not of concern. So just to make that statement out there, and we could talk about more specific questions. But that does not mean you should not be doing something, and what we really want to stress is get educated, to Tom's point, see which of these laws apply to you. It is very important to know if your products are impacted. Remember that it's beyond just cookware right now and impacting a number of industries. Find out where you are impacted. It is a complete product cycle. It's not just the product itself, it's your marketing claims as well. And I think, to Tom's point, that's going to be even more closely watched in some areas. And do something rather than nothing. I've heard some unfortunate advice being given by other associations in other product categories. That is not, to wait it out, that's not the answer. These laws are enacted, and you need to do something rather than nothing, and it's important to get going now. And if you question, if you are a part of this, come to us, come to Tobias, come to Tom, get engaged and find out where, if it applies. And remember, time and science, it took time and science to figure out where those 14,000 mushrooms fall. We need time and science to be given the time to work here as well. And it will. And I thank you all for being here today. Our contact information is on the slides. I welcome you to, if we run out of time, which I think we're a minute and 36 over, you also can come by the CBA booth in the South Hall, 3230, if you have more questions on PFAS, whether it's later today or the rest of the show. So do we have time for
Thank
questions,
you. Wayne? We have time for one or two questions, okay. If anybody in the audience wants to. Whoop, other side.
Look at that.
Hi. My question is really just thinking about some of the coatings that are available on the market at the moment. Does PFAS-free cover whether PFAS is used as part of the industrialized process, or is it purely what exists in the final product? So if you use PFAS as part of the production process, but it's burnt off or changed to make it not PFAS anymore, as in it just doesn't still have the fully carbonated fluoride, whatever.
Let me just clarify one thing, and this is, whether it was legislation or not, I do not recommend ever saying PFAS-free. I don't recommend, because here's an issue with free. Free is zero, and in the world we live in today, zero is almost impossible to achieve, because if your product ships in a plastic bag or in one of those materials that have PFAS on it, and someone went to test it and it was detected, it would be seen as that product had PFAS. So we always recommend to say made without PFAS or whatever the component is that you're saying. Free is a dangerous word in the legal world. So on that, if you are going to promote made without PFAS, to Tom's point, according to these legislations, if it has another PFAS in it, then you can't make that claim anymore. You can't even say made without because there is a PFAS in there. You want to expand?
Sure, and I think to your sort of, your underlying question, which is a really good one, because PFAS is something that is intentionally added into finished products for a specific effect. It's also something that's used very commonly in manufacturing processes. I mean, it's a mold extrusion aid. It's used in certain types of plastic manufacturing to help compounds come together. So you're right. It's both a finished product, intended component, and a manufacturing aid. I think the frustrating answer to your question is it really depends on, because there's no standard, really. For if a vendor is telling you, this coating we're giving you is PFAS-free, there's no real objective standard for what that means and how that relates to their manufacturing process. So I think what you would want to do in that situation is have the conversation with them and ask them exactly that question. You know, and if they're saying, no, we know it's PFAS-free because we've tested it, then great. But with PFAS testing, it sounds very straightforward, right? Is it in there or is it not? We can't test directly to answer that question. So there are two broad categories of tests for PFAS. There are specific analyte PFAS tests where you say, okay, this has PFOA, it has PFNA. We can, in some labs, test to up to about 100, maybe 110 individual PFAS chemicals. The other end of that is you can do total organic fluorine, extractable organic fluorine. There are different ways of describing that test, but the idea is how much organic fluorine is in this product? How much of that carbon fluorine bond is there? The problem with that is it includes things that aren't PFAS, and it doesn't tell you what concentrations of individual PFAS you have. So, you know, you could get a total organic fluorine number that is related to a pesticide that has nothing to do with PFAS. So generally what we're seeing is total organic fluorine is a screening tool. If you get a no on your TOF test, then you probably don't have PFAS in a product. If you get a yes, that doesn't mean you have PFAS. It means you should probably do a little further digging. So if you have the conversation with the vendor and you ask them, do you have test results, can we see them, know that what you get back may not really fully answer the question. And from a litigation risk standpoint, making any kind of free statement is very, very challenging. Frankly, making any kind of PFAS statements in this current environment is very challenging. But it's a great question.
Do we have any other questions? One second.
I was wondering if there's like a specific type of format to use or as a guide for putting on your websites about the PFAS, because I've seen different companies with so many different ways, so I'm confused.
Yeah. So the laws don't give you a template. You know, in Prop 65, for example, there is very clear safe harbor language, and you just copy and paste and put in the name of your chemical and you're okay. The California and Colorado laws don't really do that. They provide specific information that has to be included, but we are seeing a variety of different ways to get into compliance. I mean, the CBA, I believe, has some great example language, which is what I use when I talk to clients about this. So I would sort of start there and look at the resources that Fran has available. You know, it's sort of a risk spectrum of how much upfront work can you do to get a warning, or not a warning, disclosure out there, versus, you know, getting it 100% perfect and right. And I think what a lot of regulators are going to be looking for is best efforts to comply, because they understand this is challenging, they understand it's a big lift just to know what's in your products, let alone redo your website to include the warnings. So I would say start with the materials that Fran and the CBA has up, and then think about, you know, what's achievable in what time frame for your business.
Thank you. I think our time is up. I want to thank our panel. I want to thank everyone who attended. It's appreciated. And hope you have a great afternoon. Thanks.
Minutes.
Watching the battery,
is there any button anymore?
No, it just hung on.
It just hung up. Do you sell? If you sell to the U.S., you can. And yes, you can.
You have to join us.
With the European
Association. No, no, both of us. Both of us.
No, no. Well, well, it depends on where you're on. We work very closely together. But I mean, we do on the European side.
Yeah. I'm realizing
the American side again.
Thank you.
They have a technical committee. Our technical committee works closely hand in hand. Because it's a global issue. And so it's really more a question of what is your core.
All right, well then we have to talk more when you're back.
Just financially, with it, when you just start with a thing like that, it costs some money.
Thank you.
One of those. It's a question
for everyone in the history.
The U.S. market more important
now
is the European market.
I'm sorry, I don't have a card, but I'd be happy to talk to them, whether I'm the right resource or maybe not.
Give them space, otherwise they...
Sorry.
I'm back. Don't worry, you have plenty of time.
So sorry.
Great presentation. Clinically friendly, sustainable shopping on Amazon. So. Yeah, PFAS are near and dear to my heart, so I...
But I shop by that.
Yeah, we should have a couple of new features sneaking out soon, so
awesome.
Keep your eyes open.
Awesome. Bravo to you guys for doing that.
Thank you. It's been great.
Okay, we just need power.
Cool.
Charging. Yeah. Should be all good.
I appreciate it.